This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears. I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Two sponsors for the show this week. The episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TECH, that's T-E-C-H. And the show is also sponsored by Jam Software, makers of the Apple-focused MDM solution, the Casper Suite. Learn more at jamsoftware.com, and we'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you? Freezing to death?
Not too bad. We are getting better. Of course, we are, like the rest of the United States, under the polar vortex. So it's been quite cold here.
It's my favorite superhero.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, I think Jimmy Fallon said it sounds like a Nicolas Cage movie. So we were scheduled to come back to school on the 6th, and we were closed. It's real funny, and I think we'll talk about that in the future. I think we may be talking about that next week, but about like the ways we communicate as a school and like talking to our headmaster about when, how he makes those decisions. And of course we have to like, you know, when I was in school, you just basically watched the news and that was it. And now, you know, you posted on Instagram that school's closed, and it's just interesting to, you have to kick off that whole storm and trying to decide when to close school. And so we were off Monday, and then we had a delayed start on Tuesday. Which was only an hour delay, so it wasn't too bad. So we, at one point, it was like -5 here if you count the wind. So, yeah, a little cold.
Yeah, and of course, your -5 is colder than my -5.
How so?
Well, you're talking -5 Fahrenheit, right?
True. Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's -5 here would just be a little breeze.
So you use the weird Celsius that no one else understands.
Yeah, it's a European plot.
Yeah, well, it's like the whole metric thing. What do you know?
Yeah. It's been imposed on us from outside.
So, we're back. School's back in session, going pretty well. We had to do report cards this week, and I was finishing up those, and I always check every... So, like, in RenWeb, there's a report card section, and so you have to do these database tasks to pull the grades over. Then you have to do another database task to actually calculate the semester grade. Now, so I check each individual class, and so when I say each individual class, I mean like third grade English, third grade reading, third grade math, just to make sure like it looks right. So I'm in third grade reading, and I see one girl has a 181 for her grade for that class for the semester or for the term. I think, you know what? I don't know that she has an 181 in there, and clearly something was wrong, so we had to fix that. So yeah, otherwise she would have had the highest grade in the history of the school.
Well, don't take it away from her just yet.
Yes, no, I had to change it.
Maybe she is that good.
It was a 9. It's supposed to be a 90.9, so I fixed it. So yeah, we get report cards out, and we're back and better than ever. I guess we are back in the swing of things. Going well so far.
Good stuff. Yeah, I've had a week from hell.
How so?
First week of school. Oh, the classes that I teach, they do a thing, the exam board do a thing called verification, where they take my marking and they check that I'm marking according to the standards. And because it's new exams this year, nobody really quite understands what the standards mean yet. So they sort of gather everybody's material and have a look at it in big meetings and stuff. So basically what I have to do is assemble all my class's paperwork and put it in an envelope and send it away. But just trying to get all that paperwork together and put it in the right place and fill in the right form for everybody. It's been that on top of everything else. It's just been a little bit hit the ground running for the first week back from the new year. But that's that all gets picked up, I think, next Wednesday or something. So it'll all be over after that.
We were supposed to have an in-service on the Friday before we came back. And while I love the extra day off, in some ways it would be nice to have that day to kind of get back in the swing of things without the kids here.
Yeah, no, I'm particularly in the summer, iPad work aside, I always like to have a couple of days in school before the kids get back. But I know other colleagues who just, they can come back from holiday on the Friday and they can teach on the Monday. And I just can't quite do that. Maybe one day I'll do it, but not anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't even teach, and it's just nice to all the tasks that come through over the holidays that various things you kind of got to like get your head around. And we're celebrating our 60th anniversary this year, so there's a lot of marketing stuff that's around that, promoting the big event we're having. And so I'm involved with a lot of that because it involves a lot of email blasts and things like that. So there's just a lot of things that build up over the break. So it's nice to have the break, but it's also good to get back to the structure.
Definitely.
I think the parents are ready for the kids to come back.
Yes, absolutely. I'm ready for my kids to go back to school as well.
So before we get into kind of our main topic, I wanted to talk about CES, I guess, briefly, and particularly these like large tablets from Samsung. And I remember years ago, I guess really even like pre my days using Apple products. And so my first Mac was in 2005, was the PowerBook G4, which I still, I guess in some ways, think is the greatest computer of all time, even though it was really slow. And I used to be really interested in CES products and things that came out of there, and I'm just not anymore. And I don't know if it's because I'm kind of just very satisfied technology-wise with my iOS devices, or if what's coming out of CES is just boring.
Yeah. I think it's probably a bit of both, to be honest with you. I mean, for a few years now, it just seems to me that CES is primarily about new ways to watch the same old television programs. You know, it was 3D, and then it was, televisions that make a smell or whatever, and then now it seems this year that the big deal is televisions that are curved, like in a kind of convex shape or whatever. Doesn't really do it for me, I have to say. I think, the greatest minds of our generation are spending their time trying to make the West Wing reruns look better. I don't know. It's not super exciting. And I guess the other thing is everybody's going Me Too with a smartwatch this year as well.
Yeah. And it almost feels like this, before the iPad came out and everybody was like rushing to try to beat Apple to the punch, it almost feels like that's where we're at with that, that we're all trying to make products that are just thinking everybody wants wearables, and they're trying to solve problems they're trying to offer solutions for problems people don't really have.
Well, I think it's very much like the 3D TV situation. It was like, CES a couple of years ago was like, please could everybody just like 3D television? And this year it's please could everybody want a wearable watch, or a wearable face thing or whatever. Most of it doesn't really do it for me, I have to say. But this announcement from Samsung is actually quite interesting. And what they've announced basically is 12-inch, roughly, tablets, a couple. And one's called the Note Pro, and I think one's called the Tab 12.2 or something like that. But basically two larger scale tablets, bigger than the iPad, bigger than the Microsoft Surface. Roughly looking about the size of, if you imagine the lid of a 13-inch MacBook Air turned into a tablet, it looks a wee bit like that. What do you think about them, Bradley?
Well, I'm not against them, but my question is, show me what these can do that my iPad can't do. Because to me, it's not just about the screen being bigger. It's about enabling me to be able to do something I couldn't do before. I guess it's my concern, because it's just like with, smaller tablets, just like when you go smaller, you've got to show me something that's different. Is it more portable? Can I take it places I can't? So what is this? Is this meant to be like the Pro tablet? Because I get a lot of work done with my iPad as it is now. And I'm not saying I wouldn't want a bigger iPad. I'm certainly not saying that. But like, show me, from Samsung, show me what I can do on your tablet that I can't do on my iPad. If it's just about like having two apps running at the same time, I'm not really interested in having a Word document overlaid with tweets.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I wrote this post on my blog a number of months ago now, and it was called Beyond Consumption Versus Creation, where I kind of made the argument that what we're talking about here is not so much you can consume with this device and you only create with that kind of device, but that all these devices live in a continuum where the smaller and the more portable a device is traded off against how much complexity you can deal with on that device, or how long you can stand to use that device for. So the point I was making was that a smartphone is a great device for low complexity, short duration tasks, whereas a desktop computer is great for very high complexity or very long duration. If you want to sit at a desk for 13 hours straight and write, you're going to want a desktop computer with a vertical screen and a hardware keyboard. But if you have a medium complexity task that you do for medium or medium to longish amount of time, a tablet's a really good device for that. And I think when you start to look at these things as a continuum rather than as discrete categories, I think these tablets make a certain amount of sense, because what they're doing is they're pushing out that boundary further towards being able to handle more complexity or being able to do it for longer. Now, I think size alone doesn't mean it's possible to just use your tablet for longer, but there are some sources of complexity that may be made easier if you can see two apps at once. So let me give you a really simple example. You're writing a document and you want to refer to a web page at the same time, right? You've got some source material and you want to write about it. Now, on an iPad, you're either writing about it or you're reading the source material. And there's a certain amount of like cognitive load that is generated by the need to switch context between those two things all the time. If you were able to see both the web page and the document at the same time, that would make that task easier. So that's one kind of complexity that may be made more possible by being able to see two apps at once. That's the example I can think of, really. But what Samsung are showing with these tablets is they're showing the ability to basically have up to four apps at once in a kind of crosshair pattern. And you can drag the crosshair that separates the four quadrants of the screen. You can drag it in any direction to expand or contract certain sections of the screen. Have you ever used one of the Samsung tablets that can do two-up multitasking?
I have not. I've played with them for a total of maybe 30 minutes, but I've never gotten to that part.
I've tried a couple of them, and what I've thought with those was that they were just not powerful enough to run two apps at once. They were really, really sluggish in both respects. Now, I'm not saying I've necessarily used the most up-to-date one, but certainly the one I tried a few months ago was like that. So I'm a wee bit skeptical about the desirability or the enjoyment that you would get from running four apps at once. And I noticed that some of the specs on this thing were just through the roof. You know, it had 3 gigabytes of RAM and different stuff. And of course, if you're going to run four apps at one time, you're going to need that kind of spec. But I think I have speculated in the past about, you know, could there be a bigger iPad? And a lot of people, because of the iPad Air name, a lot of people have said, well, surely that means an iPad Pro is coming. And I think that's perhaps a little bit, I'm not sure I buy that just because the laptops are named that way. But there's an interesting design challenge here, don't you think? And the cynical amongst us, of which I probably am one, might say that the reason that you put four screens on the tablet at one time is because there aren't any really good 10-inch Android apps, right? If you take a 12-inch screen, divide it into four, then you've got something roughly the size of a 7-ish inch tablet kind of thing. And, of course, Android apps kind of have a slightly more responsive design than most iOS apps by necessity, because there are so many variations in screen size. But there are limits to what responsive design can do, I think, because nobody's really explored these kind of designs for much larger screens. And even the Mac, where there's a wide disparity of screen sizes, some apps still look ridiculous at very large screen sizes. I don't know if you've ever used, for example, you can take Twitterific, for example, in the Mac, and you can put it into full screen mode. Now, that looks ridiculous on a 27-inch iMac. It makes a lot of sense on an 11-inch MacBook Air or a 13-inch, maybe. But, you know, a Twitter client full screen on a 27-inch display don't make a lot of sense. Pages full screen view of one page, you know, it's great on a small computer. You know, that design doesn't really scale up to 27-inch display in the same way. So it's an interesting design challenge, because I think, you know, in the Apple world, we've got the phone, which is has been very closely constrained for a long time in terms of its screen size. We've got the two sizes of iPad. But then what do you do next? Would an iPad Pro, where you just took the existing iPad apps and stretched them up in the way we sort of squashed them down for the iPad Mini, would that be any good? I'm not so sure. It would give you a bigger keyboard, sure, but, you know, beyond that, it's got to do something else.
It's just a bigger device in your bag. It needs to, goes back to, it needs to enable me to do something that I couldn't do before, because you know, if there's any limitation in what I can't do on my iPad, it's not the screen size. It's maybe some of the OS. Yeah, maybe some of the inter-app sharing and things like that. That's maybe what's holding us back as much as anything. You know, in a perfect world, if I wanted to work on my iPad 100% of the time, I would love for a way to have like two iPads maybe side by side somehow in sync with each other. Like, because I really like dual displays on my Mac. But it, you know, it's as much about the OS as it is the screen size. And I've often, I was talking to my boss yesterday, we were going to change his tire, and he was talking about Samsung. And I said, I really think in about 10 years, we may look at Samsung like we do Dell. And, you know, 10 years ago, I mean, you know, at the height of the PC market, Dell seemed like unbeatable. They just had these really, really inexpensive computers. They, you know, bought Alienware. They just had that market cornered. But then, you know, they never really owned their OS. They just really were using Windows. And when Windows floundered, Dell floundered. And, you know, if Android starts to fall behind, there's only so much Samsung can do in hardware. You know, sure, they could fork it like Amazon did and make a Fire OS, like they made their Fire OS. And in some ways, I think Samsung would be smart to do that, to basically become the Samsung OS, because Amazon is not held hostage by, you know, the failures or successes of the Android platform, because they're on their own at this point. So in 10 years from now, if Samsung is still, you know, pitching, hey, we have Android version 10 and no one cares, then it doesn't matter what their phones or tablets can do.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, when you start to see Samsung push the boundaries a little bit like this, and they've done similar things with the Galaxy S Pen and some of the sort of phablet devices, they can only push that so far because they don't have the ability to like truly modify the underlying operating system the way that Amazon or Apple do, or Microsoft for that matter. And what you will find is that, you know, the question is, can Samsung persuade all the Android developers to code to their additional APIs on top of the base Android system? And I guess probably the answer is no, because, you know, there's hundreds of billions of Android devices, and not all of them are Samsung devices with a pen. So what you tend to see with a lot of these things is that all of these fancy, clever features only really work properly with first-party Samsung apps. They don't really, you know, you don't really get much of a benefit from them with third-party apps from the App Store or the Google Play Store, for that matter. So it's a question, you know, how much can Samsung do those kind of things like four-up multitasking without doing any modifications to the underlying operating system? And, you know, if Apple were to do a bigger tablet, they would be able to say, well, developers, guess what? Here's your new multitasking APIs. Let's just go ahead and make this as good as we can make it. And Samsung's a little more constrained in that respect. But it will be interesting to see. I mean, who knows, the way things are going, Samsung might be the only Android manufacturer making any money. In fact, there was a time there where they were the only ones making any money.
Well, and Microsoft is making money off Android. So quite a bit, actually. I was reading a book called, it's called The Digital Wars, and it was kind of about the history of Google, Apple, and Microsoft, kind of like 2001 on, basically roughly late 2010, 2011, right after the iPad came out. And they were talking about the Microsoft, you know, was making a significant amount of revenue, you know, not small in the grand scheme of things to their business, but it wasn't chump change from Android. So I'll put a link to that book in the show notes. It was pretty decent. You know, for me, one of the interesting announcements from CES, probably, and it doesn't have any affiliation with our show, was, I don't know, I'm not a WWE fan. I don't know if you are either, but how they announced their WWE Network, and it's going to be a digital play only. So they're going to have apps on all their iOS devices, the Roku, Kindle Fire, PlayStation, Xbox, all those things. You can subscribe to the WWE Network for $10 a month. You get all their pay-per-views, all their back catalog, basically all of their content. And I thought that's pretty interesting what they're doing. And they talked about how 30 years ago, WWE was pretty visionary going with pay-per-view, and how they made a lot of money doing that, and how in the short term, by giving their pay-per-views away for $10 a month, essentially, instead of paying $50, they're giving away a lot of revenue now, but they're setting themselves up well for the future if they start paying them $120 a year.
Yeah, I think you're going to see more of this. I mean, in the UK, I think Sky Television, who have a lot of the rights for live football matches from England. They were doing a thing where you could buy a bundle of, I think it was like 5-day passes to the Sky Sports, which is their premium cable channel that you have to buy very high-end packages on your cable subscription to get access to. They were giving away like 5 full days, 5 24-hour periods for a certain price, but it was all through their app. So you could watch the whole 24 hours worth of Sky Sports, and you could watch, you know, Formula One and whatever Premiership football was on, and the cricket and different stuff as well. So these things are starting to break up around the edges a little bit. But of course, the bulk of the market is not going to move that way very quickly. So it remains to be seen how that's going to all shake out. But it's good for us for now.
Yeah, it's baby steps. I mean, a lot of these things, we like to think long term. What does it look like? But then the reality is things move slowly, and we usually don't see radical shifts and especially content deals.
Well, I think the thing always with future developments is that people overestimate the short term and they underestimate the long term radically. So people always think, well, you know, by 2 years' time, everybody's going to be wearing a smartwatch, and in fact, by 20 years' time, there'll be brain implants, you know, or whatever. That's a trivial example, perhaps, or perhaps an exaggerated example, but you get the idea that people think next year is going to be completely different. And in fact, I mean, what is it? Is today the 7th anniversary of the iPhone?
Yes.
Something like that. You think where we are in 7 years, radically different. You know, we've changed the PC industry Apple have changed the PC industry with the iPad. But from that first day, people said, oh, I can't wait for the next iPhone because it's going to have LTE and it's going to have all this stuff, you know, or whatever. And the iPhone moved in incremental steps, but over a 7-year period, and then the addition of the iPad and iOS 7 and all these different things, iCloud, all the things that weren't there at the start, look where we are today.
Yeah, if you went back to 2000, even 10 years, you go back to 2003, 2004, look at the iPods we had. I think that's like when the iPod Photo came out. And if you look at history of technology in like blocks of time, it's huge shifts. But year to year, it's minor. It's we keep turning the dial a little bit. And of course, 2006 was obviously a lot different than 2007, and then 2009 was obviously a lot different than 2010 because of the iPhone and the iPad. But you think about those kind of shifts, and they don't happen that often, where one year is dramatically different than the next. You'll have those, and I think that's what a lot of people's, I guess, frustration with Apple is. They're expecting the next iPad every other year, and that just doesn't, I mean, what else can they do? I guess, what do you want them to do? Like make a washing machine?
Yeah, I mean, I think even the iPad was a special case of special cases, because it was the one where the expectations were so high from the start. I think the iPhone expectations were high amongst a certain group of people, but I think amongst the larger populace, people were just like, well, okay, I think Apple might have done a phone or something, I'm not sure. If you think about the in terms of the numbers that were sold after, and even the iPad as well, I mean, there were only 14 million iPad 1s ever sold. So every one of these new devices, the early ramp is always very low. The iPod was the same, but it's that curve and that adoption that really makes a difference. And I think now you're really seeing that as both Android and iOS become steamrollers. It's interesting to see, you know, that phrase, the tech, what, I'm blanking on the phrase, technology isn't interesting until the technology is boring, right? So now that we're all bored with these things, with fingerprint scanners and amazing cameras in the back, that's interesting now because everybody's got one. So let's see what happens next.
Before we move on to our next topic, let's take a moment to thank our first sponsor for the day. It's the fine folks at Squarespace. As you mentioned, Fraser, it's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TECH, T-E-C-H. Now, both of our websites are done on Squarespace 6. It's their new platform they launched a few years ago. It's incredibly easy to use. Everything is drag and drop. They have 24/7 support. They have a team in New York City that's available all day and night. I've actually been pretty, I've emailed with them off and on for the few years that I've used them, and they're always very knowledgeable. They're very personable. You know, big fans of Squarespace's support. One of the cool things about them is every template has a responsive design, and it's not just the same, same mobile design for all the templates. Each template has its own unique responsive design. Again, incredibly easy to use. My goal for 2014, I won't do it, is to every restaurant I go to just tell them about Squarespace and say that, look, this is where you need to make your website. It would be very easy for you to do. Just do it. For a free trial with no credit card required, go to squarespace.com and sign up. And if you decide to buy something, if you sign up for a trial, I think you'll like it. Use the offer code TECH, T-E-C-H, for 10% off your first purchase. We'd like to thank Squarespace for their support of Out of School. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
I always think Squarespace should give people calling cards just to leave at the front desk of a restaurant.
It just drives me nuts. Like, there's an old oatmeal comic on that, what restaurant websites, what we want out of them and what they are. Like, it's usually like a flash graphic. You can't click on the phone number, has the history of the restaurant and the owner's vision, which I'm sorry, no one cares about. Like, I want very minimal things from a restaurant website. I want the phone number. I want a clickable phone number, a clickable address, a menu that's not 100 meg PDF, and maybe a list of your specials. Like, that's all I need. That is all I need. And I could literally probably within 10 minutes in a restaurant with my laptop set up a Squarespace site for a restaurant.
I tell you the best mobile restaurant website in the world, McDonald's.com. They've nailed it on the mobile device. What you do is you go to McDonald's.com and it goes, can I use your location? Here's your nearest McDonald's and is it open now, yes or no? That's all it does.
So it's not that hard.
See what they're selling.
Everybody wants. There it is.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's showing me the dollar menu.
McDonald's is the company they are.
It's not that hard. Like, it's like they should just sit down and think, what is the minimum amount of information we need to give our people that want to come? Because I don't hang out at restaurant websites. I just don't.
I think the people that hang out at restaurants don't hang out on the websites anyway.
Well, and I think people that work at restaurants, I think the challenge is always if you're building websites, the more you put into it, the more it seems like you're doing something. But the question for me would be how do we cut stuff from this website? So, but yeah, big fans of Squarespace. I really like their new iOS apps. I think we talked about that last week, mm-hmm. but their new, I use their iPhone app a lot, and it is nice. Like, you can schedule posts. I'm a big fan of their new iOS apps. The old ones were getting a little long in the tooth, and they hadn't been updating them, and it was obvious they were making completely new ones. So,
and here we are.
Yeah. So, yeah. But want a website, go to squarespace.com, 10% off with your first purchase, offer code TECH. So,
I don't think McDonald's.com is hosted on Squarespace, though.
No. That's the one thing that's pretty cool about Squarespace. It's like, keep going back to the ad read. But with WordPress, a lot of times you can tell it's a WordPress website. But looking at your website, because you're on Squarespace 6 now, I cannot tell that that's a Squarespace site. Like, it's very unique, and you've customized it. It's nice. And you got the search button on there today, or the search box.
Yeah, when I changed over to the new site, I forgot to re-enable the search feature. And people were tweeting me going, how can I find old blog posts of yours? And I realized I hadn't put the search thing on. And it was just, go into edit mode, click a plus button, choose search, and that was it. Done. Hooked up. All good.
Yeah, easy. So what we wanted to talk about today, it's really something we talked about in show number 5. It's hard to believe we've had that many shows, is kind of where we are with the ebook world. And, again, it's been a year and a half or so since we talked about that. So we want to kind of look, has anything changed with that? Back when we talked about it, I guess September of 2012, we didn't have much to say other than it was terrible. And particularly for the models where the schools own the books and basically loan them out to the students. And so from what I can tell, we've had some improvements in the technology, but it's all around losing control of the book, though. And so we've not seen anything where the school can retain control of the book.
Yeah, yeah. It's there's certainly some new technologies have entered the market since we talked about it before. And I think I've started to see a few things, particularly in the UK, I've started to see a few things move a little bit. But the problem is the big companies are not doing it. So I mean, what do we have that's new? We've got this managed distribution technology from Apple, where this is the technology that lets you buy apps in the App Store, push them out through your MDM server, and then recall them back from devices in the future. Now, that technology is available for books, but the problem is that if you push out a book code with managed distribution, you cannot recall the book. So what they've done is they've basically let you have the same channel to deploy books and apps, but the recall feature is not available for books. Go figure. So you're really not in much of a better position with the books than you are before. All that managed distribution lets you do is it lets you send out books and apps through the same method rather than having to have two different methods, one for books and one for apps. So in that sense, you know, there's not much of an organizational change or it's just a kind of, the plumbing's a little bit different, but you know, the practical result is the same, that you've got to buy one book per student per year, regardless.
And for us, that is just not feasible financially. And that's the thing that's frustrating for us, is we would like to do with books what we do with apps, where you can push them out and get them back. And again, I'm not, you know, if we need to change the financial model of the books, that's fine. I understand that we can't buy a book that is $14.99 through the iBook store and use that license for 10 years. Because it's not even like the book wears out. I really get that. Like, I'm not looking to pay $15 for a book access for 10 years. I just am not looking to pay to rebuy the book every year at the paperback price, which is essentially what we almost have to do now.
Yeah, certainly through Apple and through Amazon. That's the deal you're offered, essentially. Now, Amazon have got this technology called WhisperCast. I think we've talked about it on the show before, but it seems to have taken off a little bit more in recent weeks and months. And WhisperCast is basically Amazon's distribution model for Kindle content. And when it first came out, I think it only supported hardware Kindles, so it was kind of like a mini MDM for Kindles, where you could push some network configuration settings to a fleet of Kindles, and then you could push content to Kindles as well. Now, WhisperCast is kind of similar to having an Apple ID in the sense that you've got to have an Amazon account per device, right? So that's another kind of bit of administrative overhead, is you've got to have another Apple ID, and not an Apple ID, but another login for a service. But it does support bulk creation of accounts, which is maybe something that Apple could take a wee hint about, which is quite handy. But still, one Amazon account per user. And there are some schools that have, there's a school in Florida, we'll put the link to the case study in the show notes, who have a one-to-one Kindle program. I had not really heard of that before. I mean, I knew it. I had heard of some schools who had talked about going one-to-one Kindle, but I didn't know that there were any schools that had actually done it. The other thing that's new about WhisperCast recently is it also supports pushing to Kindle apps. So you no longer have to have a hardware Kindle, but you could have an iPad program and have the Kindle app on your iPad and push content to the account that's associated with the app. Because I think really, just like with Apple's volume purchase, what you're doing is you're pushing content to an account, not to a particular device or a particular Kindle for that matter. But again, you can't reallocate content with that either. So with iBooks and Kindle, you're still in the situation that you talked about, Bradley, where you're rebuying books all the time without a significant discount. I mean, I think that's the point, right? Is that we're not saying we should never have to rebuy books, or that we should never have to pay reasonable amounts of money for them. But I think the problem is that the cost per pupil per year goes way, way up when we look at electronic books, at least from these big two companies.
You know, my mother-in-law picked up a Kindle for Christmas, and I'll tell you, that's a nice device. Like, if you like to, for long-form reading, that is an incredible device. And she got the Paperwhite model, and it was just, It's a fantastic device. I mean, I would never buy one because I don't like to read that much. But if you like to read, that is just that's a wonderful device.
I've had a number of Kindles. I had the first, when the first generation Kindle came out, the one with the kind of angular keyboard buttons, that was only available in the US. And then the second Kindle, the first one with the round keyboard buttons, the white one, came out. They eventually made it available to UK purchasers. But what we had to do was we had to order from America and use the US Kindle bookstore. And in some ways, that was the best time to use a Kindle because it was a lot cheaper to buy from the American store than it was to buy when the Kindle UK store finally opened. But I had that Kindle, and then I sold that Kindle. Later on, got a 3G Kindle, the first graphite one, and now I've got the first generation Paperwhite Kindle. So I've had four Kindles in my life, and you know, pound for pound, whether money pounds or weight pounds, I think the Kindle Paperwhite is probably my favourite gadget. I think it cost £109 when it came out here. My wife and I both got one. And it's just such a beautifully made, light, simple, capable, compact, just really nicely built device. I'm a real fan of the Kindle. All my ebooks that I buy are in the Kindle system. I would say I probably read more on my iOS devices than I do on the Kindle itself, but I do like to take it on holiday with me.
And they all stay in sync, too, and I think it's interesting the game Amazon's playing is because if Amazon wins, they win. If Apple wins, Amazon wins. Because the Kindle, yes. The Kindle ecosystem is getting so big. And of course, they've got their music store, which I think does pretty well. And you know, I think I may have mentioned on the episode of Mac Power Users I was on, you know, they could even get into a photo managing service.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually I've submitted a request for a trial. But they've got their basically hosted Windows desktop environment now that you can run on AWS, where they basically, for a flat monthly fee, they'll give you remote access to a Windows 7 desktop. And if that would allow me to ditch one of my virtual machines, that would save quite a bit of hardware or hard drive storage. So, they're still in beta, so I requested a trial to that. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean... So it's just very frustrating from a technology perspective that you see these books locked up in these bureaucracies that you can't get what you want. And I really think long term we should be pushing for some sort of subscription model where we say, okay, we're gonna give you guys X amount per student per year for these books. It doesn't even have to be like in the iBooks or the Kindle app. If our book companies. You know, if there's some sort of like generic container thing that where the books could just appear, maybe sign in with a Google account or could somehow interact with an MDM, just something to where it's just point and click to get the right books on the right devices to the right students.
Mm-hmm. There are chinks of light though, and I think you probably don't have this available to you, Bradley, but in the UK there's a company called RM. Who have for years been involved in selling educational technology. They're essentially a reseller who do a certain amount of research and development on top, including building their own PCs to sell to schools and various other things. But one of the things that they've done, and we had somebody come out from them to give us a demo, was they have this thing called RM Bookshelf, which is their own ebook library. So they're doing content deals with educational publishers, just for essentially for educational books, not for... you know, the top 100 novels from the New York Times or whatever, but it's textbooks and standard school texts and so on. And this is starting to get quite interesting because what you can do with RM Bookshelf, I have a manager's account with it, so I can log in and see my school situation. I can bulk create accounts for students. There's an iOS app and an Android app that lets you read the books. There's a number of ways you can work with it. You can essentially build up a school ebook library that the students can check out the books and then return the books to the school library. Now, there's a certain amount of cost. You're paying roughly a kind of library edition type price for that. So you're paying a fair amount of money for it. But you can also say how many concurrent licenses you want. So I can say, give me the ability to put 5 of these books out at once and 5 kids can take it out of the library or 20 or just even 1. Okay, and if one pupil's got it on their device, then nobody else can put it on their device until that one's returned. They also have the ability to rent a book by various time periods, such as a week, a month, and a year, for very small amounts of money. So this is essentially what you're asking for, Bradley, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, a week's access to this book for 50 pence, something like that. You can get that on RM Books, which is pretty cool. My complaint about RM Books is basically that the reading app is not very good and they don't have many of the Scottish textbooks that we might want. They're primarily got a lot of English textbooks rather than Scottish textbooks because our education systems are different. But, you know, new content can come along. That's not a problem. My bigger complaint, though, and the one that is kind of is currently, I feel, a showstopper for me, is that every book has a different combination of licensing rights to go along with it, right? So some books you can rent, some books you can't rent, some that you've got to buy, some you can get in the library, some that you don't have a library license for, and it's just, the beauty of the App Store is that every app, every single app is sold under the same terms and conditions. You pay your money, you get your app, no upgrades, no demos, whatever. It is what it is, right? And everybody understands the rules. Redownload as much as you like, download old versions only if you've got an older device, and so on and so on. Whereas with the RM bookshelf system, it's very much, well, this book's got these terms and conditions, this book's got these terms and conditions, and I can rent this one, but I can't rent that one. And my fear, really, is not so much that any one book has a particular set of terms and conditions, as much as I will start to use it, I'll start to depend on it, and then the publisher will decide to change the terms and conditions so I can no longer rent that book. And I've gone whole hog into renting these textbooks and doing all this and sort of building my school on the basis that we can rent textbooks from RM. And then, you know, one day somebody decides that's not working for us, we're just going to change the terms and conditions, and we're stuffed. So that's my concern about it. But I'm also kind of happy that it exists. And I think I'm optimistic about it for the future.
That sounds like an incredible system. You know, and it's, of course, it's always the devils are in the details on those licensing. And, you know, the frustrating thing, too, is then you start to have to research each individual book's licensing terms.
Yeah.
Where at least with Apple's solution, you know what you're getting into. And that's where I think that this probably has to be solved if one of our kind of roundtable companies, Amazon, Apple, Google, seems like one of those companies will need to solve it because they will have the power to go to the publishers and say, look, we have the customers already. We can guarantee you this kind of revenue based on what we can predict. And these are the terms. You know, it's just like how, you know, apps are, you know, same licensing on all the apps. So it's not like this app can go onto one iPad in your family. This one can go on 5. It can go on all the devices that are tied to that Apple ID. And that's the kind of what we need is simple licensing terms, easily available content, easy to distribute and manage.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the Kindle system's a little bit guilty of that as well because, you know, there's a number of features which are either able to be turned on or turned off by the publisher. So, for example, well, the X-ray feature is a little different because that's about providing a certain set of content, but the text-to-speech feature on some of the older Kindles, some books had that enabled, some books didn't have it enabled. Some books have got lending enabled, some don't, and the other one is, what's the third feature? I'm blanking on the third feature that publishers can turn on and off. Oh, yeah, it's how many Kindles your book can go on. Right, so for some books, you can put it on an unlimited number of devices. Say you've got 10 Kindles registered to your account, you can put that book on 10 Kindles. Or some publishers say 2 or 3. You know, so there's actually some embedded stuff in Kindle books as well. I've never bumped into those limits, but you know, in principle, those limits do exist as well.
Yeah, yeah, and that's you know, we're actually kind of running into that 10 device limit on iTunes Match currently at our house. We have between 4 Apple TVs, 2 iPads, and 2 iPhones, we are getting close to that. But anyways, before we move on, let's thank our last sponsor for the day. It's the fine folks at Jamf Software. Jamf Software, as we mentioned on previous shows, provides the Casper suite, and it provides IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in your organization. So this includes Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV. This is a company that's focused on Apple. They don't treat Apple devices as second-class citizens. They get software updates second. This is their focus. So if you have Apple products in your organization, this is the company you want to be partnering with for your management needs. Their Casper Focus app for the iPad allows teachers to quickly focus students' attentions, conduct secure exams with inside of an app, select specific Apple TVs, choose and distribute iBooks, and they can also prompt AirPlay. So again, it's meant for teachers to use, not necessarily IT staff. It's very, very easy to use. Visit them if there's some of their events that are coming up. If you're in London, their BETT booth is E 360, or if you're in Orlando at the FETC event, it's booth 1363. So we want to thank the fine folks at Jamp Software for sponsoring the show this week. How is your Jamp holding up with the return from Christmas? Is it still, did you see a spike on that day?
I'm seeing a really interesting issue. I'm trying to figure out whose fault it is, but I have a smart group set up in my Casper suite where it will email me every time a staff device turns off Find My iPad, right? But it keeps emailing me all the time, saying these people, you know, my own iPad, for example, you know, Fraser Spears' iPad no longer has Find My iPhone turned on. And I haven't changed it. But something, either iOS 7 is inconsistently reporting whether or not that feature's turned on or off, or Casper is, you know, incorrectly emailing me or incorrectly detecting it or something. And I'm trying to debug that problem at the moment. You know, on the balance of probabilities, I would probably suspect iOS 7, but there you go. But that is a nice feature. I think it's in the latest, either the latest or the latest but one version of the Casper suite, is the ability to detect from an iOS 7 device whether or not Find My iPad is turned on or not, which is quite cool and quite useful. Because it's part of our security protocol to have staff devices have a locator service turned on all the time. So that's what we're using. We're playing with that just now.
It'll be interesting to see your uptick to 7.1 whenever that drops, which I imagine will be quite soon.
Yeah, I had a maintenance window today for my last batch of devices that are not on 7.04. And I thought, you know what, I'm not going to bother. I'm just going to leave them on 03 until 7.1 comes out. I put the 7.1 beta on my iPad Air today. Nothing has gone on fire yet, which is great. But due to non-disclosure agreements, I can't say more than that. But I can confirm it is not causing any unexplained fires so far.
And it was not a pre-release of iOS 8 either?
Nope. It does not have the Platinum interface from macOS 8. I can't believe it. I'm about to kind of wrap around again and have the same version numbers on a whole new operating system that I hadn't. You know, we had macOS 8, then OS 10.8, and now iOS 8. And we're going to run out of numbers soon.
10.3.9 was my first macOS.
10.3.9.
I remember.
I had Developer Preview 4 was my first.
I remember ordering Tiger from the internet, delivered to me in a giant box.
It was a giant box as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a giant box with the disc inside, and it was like $129, and it's just kind of funny how, you know, looking back, I guess probably 10.5 was such a huge upgrade looking back, you know, going from Tiger to Leopard, that, you know, Leopard was huge. You know, brought Time Machine and some other great things that really kind of at the core of macOS now. But so, you know, one of the things I was kind of pondering this over the past week is, the book companies are kind of, you know, not doing what we would like as customers. So are textbooks as we know in danger of becoming irrelevant in the classroom? You know, again, not tomorrow, like we said, how things are going to change and like this doesn't happen quickly, but over the next 10 to 15 years, if the book companies don't get on board with some of this stuff, will teachers just find alternative content?
Possibly. I mean, I think, you know, some people say that the future of textbooks in school is for teachers to write their own. I don't buy that. And I don't buy it for two reasons. One is most teachers don't have the time to do it. Two is most teachers don't have the ability to do it either, to be quite frank. And I know because I'm one of them, because I've thought about it and started it a couple of times and thought, no, I can't do this. But I mean, maybe you could do it, Bradley, as a published author.
my last book was 20 pages.
So. Stretch your legs a little bit. But I think what is possible is that the textbook will be heavily augmented by more up-to-date resources that come from the internet. And those resources will not be provided by the textbook provider. Right, so at the moment, I've got these new textbooks for the course I'm teaching this year. And in the front, it's got like a link where you can download a bunch of files that are tied into the exercises in the book. And that's fine and good as far as it goes. But what I prefer to do in my teaching is I prefer to you know, textbook's fine, I'll use it, but I'll add to it with what I know based on resources that I have access to elsewhere. So, for example, you know, I'll use my iTunes U course alongside the textbook, and I'll refer to the textbook from my iTunes U course, but I'll also link to Wikipedia, and I'll link to videos on YouTube, and I'll link to newspaper articles on the BBC or on The Guardian or wherever as well. And I think the textbook is not going to go away. And there are a couple of reasons for that, which I'll talk about in a minute, but it will be one of many learning resources. And realistically, that's what it's always been. But you know, in some schools or some countries, it's been more of the all-encompassing idea than before. But I think there's a couple of reasons the textbook isn't going to go away. One is that it provides a certain amount of consistency. And I know in the US, the textbook is particularly prized for that, and you know, you have these, I mean, you guys have these political battles about what goes in the textbook and what doesn't, etc., etc., and that is, you know, while I don't think those political battles are particularly helpful, I also think that having at least a common understanding of what is in this course and what is not is very useful. And in Scotland, we don't have mandated textbooks for courses. There are multiple companies producing textbooks for the same course, based on those authors' interpretation of what the exam board publishes the standards for the course, which is, I think, quite a good situation to be in. But I think particularly, because I'm feeling this right now, teaching a brand new course, it's very helpful to me to have, you know, here's another interpretation of these content standards. I mean, I've read all those standards and I know what they say and I know what I think they mean, but it's helpful to me to have a book that gives me another person's interpretation of those standards. And sometimes I concur with them, other times I don't, and we can sort of come to a common understanding of what these standards actually mean. And I think textbooks are useful for that, as long as they're good. The problem is when a textbook becomes dominant in a field and it's actually not very good, that's more of a problem. And I think the augmentation of textbooks with other content is perhaps the most interesting part of this whole thing. You know, teachers, I doubt, are going to write their own, but they will write small textbooks. I mean, I think your book, Bradley, is a perfect example of using iBooks Author to do something that is limited in scope. You know, and I've been trying to talk, when I talk to people about iBooks Author, you know, apart from the awkward fact that it requires a Mac, which nobody wants to hear about anymore, what I try and say to people is, look, you don't have to write a book to use iBooks Author. You can do smaller things. And I think if there's one thing that iBooks Author does a great job of, it's helping teachers take a small amount of content and turn it into something that looks quite good. And I think I've described it before as like Keynote for books, where with Keynote, you can take a small amount of content, turn it into something that looks pretty good with not a lot of effort. And if you do put in a bunch of effort, you can get something that looks really great. And that's kind of what I feel about it right now. I think textbooks are still useful, but the question is, you know, are they going to appear in the form that we want them to appear? And these books I'm referring to, Bradley, they were only written last year, and none of them are available digitally at all, as far as I know, which to me is kind of amazing, but true.
Now, that does blow your mind, that something written in 2013, you cannot, you know, because I can't get it. Our fifth grade textbooks, none of them are available in digital formats in any form. And you just stand around and think, is someone punking me? And is this like when you're searching their website, like, is this really going on? Like, how are you guys not there yet? I mean, again, I know things move slowly and I know big companies move slowly, but the iPad has been out since 2010. The Kindles, when did the Kindles come out? Was it 2007?
Seven, yep.
And so they've got to know this was coming. And we've seen, particularly here in the U.S., we've seen no movement. Again, if your school's model is that the kids buy their own books, and I know some of the middle and high schools near us do that, you can piece together your book collection through 9 different apps. It's possible. But it's not, you know, A, that's not ideal, and it's very complicated. And not a good experience for the teacher, the parents, nor the students. But I would think a lot of schools are like us, where they're saying, hey, here's your content. You know, here's the book we want. Here's the version we have. This is what you're using. And even if the digital version is available, it's dramatically more expensive. So like if you look at like buying a paper copy of something and using it for 5 years versus having to buy five copies of that book, you know, one every year for the same for the student, the electronic book becomes drastically more expensive and not really that much better of an experience in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's what we're really getting to, I think, Bradley, is there's two sides to this debate. There's one side who say, there's two parts to our side of the debate, right? We want electronic books. There's people who don't want electronic books, and those are a different class of people altogether. They like to sniff books for some reason. But in the camp of people who would like to see electronic books further developed, there's some of us who just want an electronic version of the paper. And then there's people who think that the book itself could be reconceived as something completely different. And I think one of the interesting parts of this is that at the same time as this is all going on with iBooks Author and things like that, and new multimedia parts coming into the book, there's also iTunes U growing up at the same time. Now, we use iTunes U quite heavily in school. And of course, there's other things. There's Khan Academy, and there's been other, virtual learning environments built over the years. And talking to our teachers, you know, I've said, well, why don't you use more iBooks Author stuff? And they all said to me, well, we've got iTunes U. Why do we need that to make something in iBooks Author? Because what they saw was that iTunes U was very dynamic. It was very responsive to the needs of the class on a daily basis. You could put something in iTunes U as required and then not put it in when it wasn't required. Quickly add something or quickly change something. Whereas everybody perceived writing a book as being something very heavyweight, even if it was a short book, very heavyweight and very static, and you would do it maybe once a year, and they wanted actually to be more responsive to the class's needs rather than a bit more static. So that's, to me, that's another interesting thing just to bear in mind as we go through this is, does it have to look like a book at all? Maybe it's an iTunes U course rather than a book.
And even, again, maybe if there was some way for publishers to provide content integrated into iTunes U, where schools could say, subscribe to that. We're going to buy this class content for this many students this year. And you would rebuy it every year. And maybe it's, various PDFs that are embedded into iTunes U and things like that. That could be doable. And
well, there's no reason in principle why iTunes U courses couldn't be paid for. I mean, they come through the iTunes store. And it just so happens the rule right now is that they're all free and there's no mechanism to set a price for one. But in principle, could you? Absolutely. You know, next version of iTunes U could have a buy button on it. Definitely.
And then it could be integrated into MDM solutions. So in your Casper suite, you could say, okay, this iPad needs to have access to this iTunes U course, and you could automate the whole thing. And of course, you've, I think, said this before on Twitter, is do you want to lock up your iPad as a book reader only if you do kind of go the traditional book inside of iBooks or book inside of the Kindle app?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, that one-to-one Kindle program is very interesting to me because, you know, if the Kindles continue to slide in price, I mean, the first Kindle was $400. And what's the current one? Like the cheapest one, $69 or something?
Yeah, and I saw it on sale for $50 during Christmas. And you've got to think that they're trying to get that price down to as close to free as possible.
I'm absolutely convinced that, you know, within our lifetimes, in fact, you know, much sooner than that, if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, you'll get a free Kindle with your first order of an electronic book. I absolutely believe that will happen. I thought it might have happened by now. Maybe overestimated the short term a little bit. But I can see a day coming when that's absolutely the case.
Yeah, that's definitely a good possibility. And so then you think, could you deploy, you know, a book reader and a tablet? So
absolutely.
Possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think... A $69 Kindle. There was a case study of an operation in somewhere in Africa, I think maybe Malawi, but I'm maybe making that up, where they sent a bunch of Kindles out preloaded with content to promote literacy and reading in that area. And, you know, the overall project, I think, was very successful, but one of the things they found with that was that there was something like a 40% failure rate of the Kindle device itself because it was not built to be robust in that sense. And I just slightly worry, you know, a $69 device or even less, you know, a free with purchase device, how cheaply that would have to be built. Would it actually survive? Not absolutely sure. There'd have to be some kind of replacement program involved in that too.
So yeah, it's interesting kind of the tunnels you could go to from our initial vision of what we'd like books. And there is light at the end of the tunnel. There may be on alternative paths, but there certainly is light. And long-term technology often solves these solutions for us.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, a book is, you know, a textbook in particular is a container for, you know, parts of learning. And if I look at some of the textbooks I use, they're not particularly cohesively integrated chapter to chapter. You know, it's like, here's a chapter about this, here's a chapter about that. And in many cases, you know, bigger textbooks, the chapters are written by different people. So there's no reason why they necessarily have to be all stitched together in a book when they go digital. You could start to see some of that being unbundled as well. I mean, there's a company a while ago called Inkling who tried to make it possible for you to buy or rent university-level US textbooks by the chapter because they're very, very expensive books. I've not heard so much about Inkling recently, but that was an interesting idea for them. Now, for us, the textbook's not that expensive. So there's also geographical variations here. You know, I'm only paying £8 or £9 for a textbook. I'm not paying $200 like some US students are paying for their textbooks. So that's something to bear in mind as well. You know, when Apple sets a price for their iBooks Author textbooks, that price is a massive price cut in the US, but it's not a massive price cut in the UK. In fact, it's a price increase for us because our paper books were cheaper than that to start with.
Time will tell, I guess.
Time will tell. Things have moved a little bit since we last spoke about it, I think. And it's interesting just to check in on the topic again because, you know, somebody's got to do something to make the market move a little bit. And, you know, maybe it is just the pressure that a lot of schools have got these devices now. We're far enough down the road and people want to start selling to them. That's fine. Hopefully if that's what makes it move, that's what makes it move. We'll see.
Yes, we will.
Good times.
Yes.
Okay. Shall we leave it there for this week?
I think so. Let's make sure to thank our sponsors for this show. Find folks at Jamp Software. If you want to learn more about them at jampsoftware.com, and the fine folks at Squarespace, remember use the code TECH, T-E-C-H, for 10% off your first purchase, and that also lets them know that you heard about them from the show.
Okay, so where can people find us on the web, Bradley? Our new logo, we should mention our new logo. Our friend Scott Boucher just came along and dropped the new logo on us, which we love. It actually has a representation of a book, which is quite cool. So you can find that at outofschool.net on the show website. Your iPhone is probably already showing the logo to you on the home screen. You can find my newly Squarespace 6 blog at spears.org. I'll try and write some more this week or next. And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter. Bradley, where can people find you?
I'm on the web at chambersdaily.com, and I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
Okay, we'll talk to everybody next week.
Have a good week, everybody.
Stay warm.